Thanks, everybody, for coming this afternoon. I want to start by addressing the most obvious question, which is, why are we having a book party on Super Bowl Sunday? Just a couple of hours, 2 hours before the Super Bowl, or roughly. And for those who know our family, you may think that that's the result of our singular focus on musical theater as opposed to anything sports related. And that is, you know, possible. A more generous interpretation might be that we are trying to provide the counterweight to a two-hour spectacle of 300-pound men crashing into each other, or an intellectual exercise that offsets your 3,000 calories of nachos later. Either one of those is possible. Whichever you choose to believe, I'm delighted to introduce my friend, dear friend, Dr. Andreas Weigand. I have known Andreas for 17 years. We just calculated today. The occasion for his visit is a book that he's written, which we'll talk about. Andreas, just by way of introduction, is currently a professor at UC Berkeley in the information department, but he's had a fantastic career in teaching as a professor at other schools, NYU, Boulder, Stanford, Shanghai, what's the name of the university?
Shanghai Jiao Tong University and Fudan.
Okay, yeah. Beyond my pronunciation skills, clearly. What's amazing about Andreas is his ability to collect and catalog stories. I mean, he's as good as anyone I've ever met at not just cataloging them, but then teasing out the thing that they represent and being able to use that to teach. And if you have the chance to read his book, which I hope you all will, you will see that there are hundreds and hundreds of stories. I mean, so many stories, sometimes more than one on a page. It's that good. And that makes it really engaging and relatable in a non-academic way. I would say it's so relatable, it's almost the Hamilton of data books. No pressure. He'll be wearing a wig later. So we'll talk. So I'm gonna interview Andreas a bit to see if I can tease out some of these stories from him. And we'll definitely not be able to touch on the range. It's a sweeping book, so we will not touch on the full range of what is covered in the book. Just by way of background, so Andreas doesn't have to do it, the book gives you the history of data, essentially, centuries worth, as well as the current context for that is so relevant today as it relates to data privacy and availability, and then gives us some frameworks for thinking about data moving forward, because we're at a somewhat critical juncture in terms of the way we think about it. He also points out some of the ways in which our thinking may not be aligned with the realities of data today. And I'll try and tease out a little bit of this in story form from Andreas. I met Andreas when we both worked in a fintech or financial data startup in the Bay Area. And as I said, I'm very pleased to 17 years later be speaking with him. So Andreas, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
So when I got to this financial startup, I was introduced to Andreas as the chief scientist. And this is the year 2000. And I have to, hopefully you'll forgive me for not having any idea what that meant. He was happy to educate me. But for those who have not met a chief scientist or a data scientist before, can you just start by telling us what that is?
So I first learned about the term data scientist long before I had used it from Terry, who is sitting there next door. And that was an event The Economist had done with Ken Cukier, where basically the data detectives, as we called ourselves, people look at traces, people leave and then put the picture together, people ask good questions where the data might be the answer. Where, you know, that was the world we lived in. When I was associate professor at NYU, I wrote a paper on how we can, by the traces they leave, identify traders and sometimes not the best patterns of those traders, like people doubling down and hoping for the best. And then, of course, I went to Amazon and I looked at the traces people leave as they're making decisions. And then the last few years I spent, working with companies looking at the traces people leave there. And I've been very interested as a data scientist in what questions can we answer with the data people leave.
So you... He upgraded slightly from working with me to Jeff Bezos. I'll give him that.
They have in common that I remember
Right, we both use Amazon.
Yeah. When, yeah. When I was very excited to run into an old friend of mine when Paul and I were actually at Lehman Brothers in those days. And I said, that is my boss. And Paul said, you know, that's what I've thought for the first 20 minutes. I think Jeff would make a similar remark.
Yes, yeah. Let's talk about what you did for Amazon, because there's, if you go back to 2002 when you joined them, right?
Yeah.
Even then, that was pretty forward-thinking for Jeff Bezos to have a chief scientist. So talk about what that involved and what you accomplished.
Another thing we have in common is that D.E. Shaw, David Shaw, he funded the fintech startup we were in, and he was Jeff Bezos' boss.
Yeah.
So when Jeff was thinking he would like to have a person who actually knows how to do experiments, so they were thinking maybe they should find an experimental physicist, because that's what physicists do, they run experiments. My PhD thesis at Stanford was in neural networks, and that was 20-something years ago. That was really where data were used to learn models without understanding the underlying principles. Mm-hmm. So basically, Amazon had embraced that idea even before I came. And then one thing which probably Jeff and I spent like 50 hours on was writing down the equation of business. And what that really was trying to figure out from a customer-centric perspective, if we had all the data in the world about these customers, what weight would we put at actions Amazon has taken and decisions they are making? Mm-hmm. So that notion of an equation of business, we called it fitness function. And I think that applies to far more than just e-commerce.
So some of the elements of that equation, just for people to get a real sense of what that meant.
Here's an example. Paul said today, you know, you never find that Amazon phone number. And I said, what are you talking about? Because one of the experiments we ran was whether we should make it easy or whether we should make it hard for people to reach us. Answers, the easier it is, the better. It's actually, people who have a call answered by Amazon tend to be better customers than people who never called Amazon. So we went onto my little laptop and I said Amazon cust, and it always said 188, whatever the number is. And, you know, being Andreas, I just call the number. And somebody answered within two rings. So I knew to come up with something. I said, oh, I just wanted to thank you. What? Yeah, you just sent me an email that you credited me back $1.80, including tax, off the book I just bought, which happened in my book, because the price dropped. So I want to thank you. And so that made the point that we did lots of experiments trying to figure out how reasonable people can disagree. One topic, actually, now I'm going off script, if that's okay. Yeah. One topic was the question about real identity. I absolutely was pushing for pseudonyms, last but not least because Dave Holtzman. And I had been talking about pseudonyms for ages, that you don't want to reveal your real name if you can have a persistent pseudonym. Not anonymity, I hate anonymity, but persistent pseudonyms. Like when I know him as Dave, but when we go to a restaurant, he says John. And so that is enough, you know, because some other John might actually be ready before Dave. We talk about Johns and pimps and prostitutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So those experiments, boiling the results into an equation, that I think really summarized what Amazon's thinking was then and still is.
Mm-hmm. So you worked for a company that you now consider, use the analogy data or the term data refinery, and you have this oil metaphor that runs throughout the book. Could you talk about how you think about data refineries and their role in the data ecosystem?
Yeah. So for me, that metaphor came from a saying which actually, I thought we had figured out, Peter Hirschberg and I, before we were invited to give a talk to the General Assembly of the United Nations, where we call it Data is the New Oil, only to see that like 50,000 people had used this before us. But it is still a good metaphor because it shows that if you just have raw data, it doesn't really mean much. The value of data is helping you make decisions. So the value of data is the impact it has on decisions. So a data refinery, and think Google, Amazon, Facebook, is to take data to combine it with your data. You give a data in order to get something you actually want. The information that comes out is something which helps you make better decisions, whether it's buying things or where to go, how to get there. If you think about a navigator, you know, who to date, whatever part of life you're in.
So the idea of using an equation based on this data is something that we could take moving forward, and it's something you talk about in the book, making your thinking explicit through equations. When we first worked together, I think we were 2 or 3 days into our joint tenure at this startup, and I asked Andreas if he would do a brainstorming session with me. And so we had a whiteboard set up, and there were two things that were different about this session. One was that he would not let me have the marker, which was, I thought was very aggressive. But and the second was that as I was making points, he didn't write a single word that I said. But what he did write was an equation. And across our conversation, Andreas built an equation that was several lines long, and I could not decipher, by the way, but he knew what he was doing. And so that was my first exposure to this concept, which obviously is much richer now. And when you think about the way equations are now being applied to this exponentially growing data repository we have, there are some interesting ones. Maybe not in the United States, but there's some interesting things happening. You talk about social credit score, Sesame. I think people would probably be interested in that.
So I first worked with Jack Ma at Alibaba in, I think, probably 2001. Many years later, Alibaba has become a big company, and they have something called Sesame Score. And it actually was, like everything, you know, blessed by the government. In the government's 2015 plan for 2020, a social credit score. So since I said data is only worth as much as the decisions depend on it, let me talk to you about some of the decisions. Let's say, you know, you want a job. If your social credit is below a certain level, that job is not happening. Or you have a child and you want the child to go to school to get a good education. Again, if your social credit score is below a certain level, sorry about that. What the Chinese did is very, very systematically take, you know, all bits of data you can think of. For example, a friend of mine writes a software for the Public Security Bureau, and they in real time know when you check into a hotel. So if you are checking into a hotel a couple of nights in a row, like at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., bad news. But I didn't want to start with the negative aspect. So, the things are, let's say, you start with a certain level based on the transactions you have on Alibaba. You are jaywalking, minus 1 point. You are shoplifting, minus 5 points. You are selling counterfeit goods on Taobao, plus 50 points, because you know that helps Taobao. So you have a very explicit way of all the things you can think of baked in one equation, and out comes your social credit.
Can you talk about this, the truly social piece of this, your familiar relations?
The truly social piece is, you know, somewhat sketchy. So I always ask in class, or when I talk in China, I always ask everybody, get up. That's what I learned from Paul. So everybody gets up, and you know, I ask them to pull out their phones and to look up their credit score. And if it's below 500, you can sit. 600, you can sit. 700, you can sit. And a few people are standing up, and then I go, and so, you know, how did you actually manage? And one thing which consistently comes up is you get your score up by just simply buying and selling shit on Taobao. But now sometimes your score goes down without you having done anything. But then Alibaba helps you out, because it tells you which of your friends might have done something which, and just by being friends with them, unfortunately, you know, they had to take your score down. So you then, you know, let's say something, posted something on Weibo which the government didn't like. You know, you can help them out, and they can, you know, fix your score by them taking that down and maybe writing an apology for that. So that's a pretty amazing surveillance state, which is much more powerful than just having cameras recording it. I mean, I used to say that what the KGB doesn't get out of people under torture, people are now voluntarily revealing on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. That is true. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about then the whole framework and concept of privacy and why maybe on balance we don't think about it correctly now? Yeah.
David Holtzman wrote that book, Privacy Lost, 10 years ago. And he came to class November, I think, at Berkeley. And I had a wonderful setup with him. He used to work for the NSA. And Nikki Oza, who works for the ACLU. And we were trying to figure out, what is the hope we have? Is it legal? Is it technology? Is it something else? And I think that, to be honest, I think we have no choice about privacy. I think the choice we have is to lie to ourselves, to live the illusion that people don't know you are here, or to embrace it, but then see what we can do as citizens to get companies to provide us with tools and to get the government to provide us with tools so we can actually look in what's happening, not only with our own data, but with our data in comparison to other data, and to get help for the decisions we need to make.
So you actually propose 6 data rights. I think they're grouped into transparency and agency.
Yeah.
Transparency may be self-evident. It's the ability to see. Well, why don't you describe the two?
Yeah, so actually, Obama actually said we have the right to access our data. So transparency, one, means you have the right to understand what data is being collected about you, but it's really that companies build tools so you can make sense of the data you have. It's not enough to just ship over some binary file to you. The other transparency right is the right to inspect the refineries, because I want to know what's happening in there. I want to know also how secure are they. I want to have access to, you know, some white hat hackers, a report which the company had where they say, here are the security breaches. I want to have an overall score, like when I buy a fridge, it tells me how energy efficient it is. I want to have a score telling me, are they using two-factor authentication for people to log in? Are they running the last patches on the software for security and so on? Mm-hmm. So those, I think, are the rights to see my data and to understand the refinery.
And the agency piece?
The agency, ultimately, I believe that if you don't do anything with the data, then it's useless. So it's about the decisions you make. What actions can you take as an individual? One of them, for instance, is the right to blur your data. That I stole or was inspired from by Eric Horowitz at Microsoft Research a few years ago at a workshop at Google. And I just saw a blog, Microsoft blog, a few days ago, where they now had some new ideas, which are very sort of similar to what I had in the book, that you have the right to determine the granularity of your data. There is no hope on believing that you can change the data at the source. Verizon, AT&T, whoever you have here in your house knows, you know, how we are sitting, how we are moving, no question. Google knows when I'm reading my email in the morning, where I'm reading my email. But I wonder if the right to determine to which precision they can process those data. And the deep hope I have with this book is that people will understand the trade-offs they are making. So it is not black and white. We don't live in a binary world. I want people to understand that if you say, blur my data off the resolution of a city block, that poor Domino's pizza delivery man, he doesn't know where to bring the pizza.
Yeah.
You can't have both. Please don't tell anybody you know where I am, and the delivery man to show up.
Right. So the fear that many people have in the United States and other places is that there's a more nefarious purpose beyond even just commerce to collecting and analyzing data. You've seen across cultures, countries, different attitudes toward this. and I mean, what you're talking about now, this give-get, which relates to this post-privacy world. Is there, do you have any just general comments on how we should be thinking about that topic?
Yeah. I think, not surprisingly, think about it really as an equation with trade-offs. Try to make it explicit for yourself. Like, for instance, what is the time constant you have? How much do you decay the future? The future in 10 years is not as important as what's happening 1 year from now, maybe. So what is this called hyperbolic discounting? What is your time horizon? By making the implicit explicit, you'll be better off. We as society will be better off. At Amazon, we always used to say, it's much easier to agree on the equation before the data is in. Mm-hmm. Because if I have some idea and you have some idea and run the experiments, I am, of course, in favor of what came out here if it supports me, and you would say the other way. Mm-hmm. Writing that equation and being clear that different people can have very different terms. So, for instance, in the EU, the focus is on limiting the downside. So if you're running a company in the EU which has consumer data, you spend 90% of your time. What's the worst thing that can happen and how you can make this slightly better? Silicon Valley, that doesn't get you a job. What gets you a job there is, what's the best that can happen? And that's how you get evaluated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very interesting. So in the EU, we have the right to be forgotten, to be delisted. In the US, I want the right to be remembered. So I want the Googles of the world to actually keep my data and to make it easy for me to be discovered, mm-hmm. as opposed to make it easy to be forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Are you okay with taking some questions?
I'm totally.
Sure. Don, please go ahead.
I'm so many decades behind you. Nevertheless, maybe you can address these two questions, or your choice. Number one, when the NSA was starting to reveal that there was NSA wiretapping and things like that, one of my friends said, as long as you're not doing anything illegal, what do you have to worry about? To which the response was, well, that may be true of you, but if the president, whoever that may be, knows that a senator is doing something not illegal but problematic,
right,
there's a bribery or a corruption potential. And that's a very micro level bit of data. It's not the broad strokes you're talking about. The other question is, we're also beginning to see now a kind of negative data kind of thing in which people like Twitter and Facebook are arguably trying to steer your searches in such a way, not just so that you get the refrigerator that you look for on Amazon appearing, but that you don't get political opinions or articles about things that they don't want you to see.
Yeah. So. Great point. Let's just go back 2,000 plus years in history. Plato's Allegory of the Cave. So just to remind you, it's some prisoners sitting, their heads fixed, they can't turn left, they can't turn right, and all they see is the wall of that cave and what we would call shadows moving on that wall. Those shadows in our world, of course, are projections from stuff behind them which you can't see, so some light source and some people or puppets, we don't know. And they have their way of talking about those shadows, like, for instance, they don't jump around, they move continuously, and so on. No different now. It is just that it is not that we're looking at Plato's wall, but we are looking to the world according to Google, or the world according to Facebook. And the way Google projects things, so Google doesn't make things up, Facebook doesn't make things up, just like those shadows were not made up. But what gets highlighted, they call it search relevance, or they call it feed. That is very, very much how our world gets created. The social and otherwise construction of reality. So not entirely new. Good old Plato knew that. Well, Kant would have said we can't go beyond that. These are the categories. And what Plato actually said is that one prisoner And I don't say we are prisoners. I don't like to have that argument for us. So one of these dudes, I guess, got up, and then he turned his head, and he saw this blinding brightness. I hear, oh, it's not for me. And he went back and sat with the others and said, hey, what? How was it? Oh, awful. I didn't see anything. So I think that pretty much is the challenge we have. So one of my rights is the right to amend. I believe anybody should be able to comment on any piece, not only of news, but of any fact in the world. Just as we have the hundreds of billions dollar industry that shows us relevant results when we search, or that shows us relevant ads when we do whatever we are doing, that $100 billion industry, I think, should be used to surface to us what we believe is the truth. There is no authority who can decide on this is true and this is false. I absolutely believe that the only solution we have is by observing what people say, by observing what people do. And we do have the precedence in search that if people have short clicks, they click on something and a second later they are back to the page, versus a long click where they actually engage and maybe, as now our case today, even make a phone call. Where all of that's observed, I think that is the only way how we actually can figure out what's the case and what's not the case.
Can I press on that? Just Nazi Germany.
In Germany, my grandparents knew that trains were going to Auschwitz. When my father, his grandmother was Jewish, when his family disappeared, he said they all knew what had happened. So I think it is not that people didn't know. They didn't have a way for collective action. Well, let me give you two quick stories. China. China, the air is not the best. The Chinese government published amazingly clean air scores, and there was the alternative truth, or whatever they call it, the alternative fact of the United States embassy in Beijing, which was just propaganda. And then there was a do-it-yourself movement of people building detectors, a Tor-like way, this anonymous browser, a Tor-like way of uploading the data from their party detectors, PM 2.5. And so suddenly, there were many measurements in the country consistent with the U.S. consulates and the U.S. embassy in Beijing, and very different from the official truth. And the Chinese government backpedaled, and, you know, slowly those numbers converged. So I think that's a beautiful story, how data, which, by the way, most people in China, when it's bad, look every day. What is the PM 2.5? Am I going out or am I staying in? So it's not that these data have no actionability. But it was the data by the people became actually data for the people and against the government. I don't understand why Trump's tax return hasn't appeared in WikiLeaks yet. And there must be somebody who really solidly protected by the technology would put the damn stuff up. So that is more what I'm surprised about than...
I think the complexity of what you're talking about is informed opinion versus observable fact.
So, and having a refinery or an intermediary, because we don't all have time to go measure our air quality.
So I think that is the case, and also just what I call data literacy. Last year, the proposal of asking people for their main social media account as the end of the United States, that was brain dead for anybody who ever has thought about it. Because if you are a terrorist, then the last thing is you're putting down your official personal Facebook account. I mean, come on, they have the training. If you're not a terrorist, if you're some innocent kid who maybe has a typo and then it's not found and then he lied on an official government entry form and is denied entry. I just don't understand how that kind of data, intelligent people of either party, can actually even think about asking visitors entering the United States of America.
I have read the books. I loved it. and everybody should read it. But there was one point in there that I thought was especially interesting, which was your right to being able to see, I don't know what word you use, but the algorithmic process being used by the refineries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's nothing like that today. How do you think, and I think this is the crux maybe of where you're headed with this book, how can you hold Google and other refineries accountable to provide this level of transparency? Because it feels to me this is the rock that your proposal is based on.
I think we should open up a little bit more for discussion than just having me answering questions.
You're not going to solve this? What are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
You guys will work it out.
Exactly.
You guys will work it out.
China and air pollution was a good one too, but so we're placing a lot of strength on these data refineries, which I wasn't scared about until I read your book.
Yeah. But I believe sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Yeah.
So
sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Photography is not a crime, which is a website about taking pictures of police officers, and I'm notorious for getting in trouble with these things. Actually, right after Charles, on that United plane, I saw beautiful raindrops on the window, and I had no interest in anything else but taking a good picture of those raindrops. Now, it's a big difference, apparently, to flight attendants, whether you're taking this with an iPhone or your Canon 5D. So immediately she came, I already was not on great terms with her. She already came and said, if you don't take this down now, then we will turn back and say, United Planes already had once turned back from me. Known procedure, but I'm happy to take the camera down. And then, after that was done, then half an hour later, I said, excuse me. And no aggression here, not pick the camera out. Just to be clear, I first asked Kevin, all listening in, why did you ask me to take the camera out? Oh, picture of airport operations are illegal. I said, oh, okay, thank you. Another 10 minutes, I said, excuse me, I was wondering, do you have that as a rule? Can you show it to me? Oh, yes. And she came back with a flight manual. And nothing talked about airport operations. So it said, pictures of other passengers. So that we all know. Then I asked her whether I can take a picture of the manual. I mean, that's how it would be. No. And if I don't behave now, then, I will be met by the authorities. So I don't ease it back time, but I don't want to be met by the authorities that we had that one. So I think it is really creating transparency, putting those things up. There's a big difference. We talked about it earlier today. Something like Sesame Score. If it is actually very clear to each citizen what they need to do, that is one thing. What I really resent is if you do not know the equation. So if your score fluctuates up and down and you do not know why, that is just the least empowering thing. Like, for example, I was going to give a talk at Microsoft. Now, NPR Marketplace had a little story earlier this week where the headline they picked was, "Large software company makes 1 billion people lie." In case you ever have had like a usage agreement and you said, I have read and understood the previous 40 years, I have to lie on that because even if I read it, I'm not sure I would understand it. Somebody there thought they need to protect the employees at Microsoft against such elements who make them say that their customers are forced to lie. I would like transparency. So when my PR person said, I'm sorry to inform you that Microsoft canceled your talk, I said, oh, I would love to talk to them about it. What is it that bugged them? Oh, no, I can't reveal who said that. That is the least empowering if you get denied something you don't know why. So I'm a physicist by training, and the last century really had two shocks to the system, to physicists. The first one was pretty much 100 years ago, quantum mechanics, that you cannot know both the location and the velocity of a particle with arbitrary decision. That was a shock to how people understand the world. And then the second shock was in the 50s or so, when it's called chaos theory, where small errors over time increase exponentially. That also people didn't want to hear. They were not ready that a small error at some stage blows over and, you know, the butterfly in Beijing make right. Many things you can see. You can form a pretty good model of what the algorithm does, which is very different from really deterministically in knowing what it really will do. So it depends on the data, there are fluctuations. Being right 90% of the time, or maybe even 99% of the time, is good enough there. So having 10% or 1% of the time is something sneak in that you really didn't care for. What's the alternative? So I think getting a good feeling about what it overall does, what it does for you. And I claim that you all have that feeling when it comes to Amazon recommendations. You have a feeling about why things are recommended. And if every now and then something comes that you don't want, you know, what's the alternative? I think we don't have much of an alternative.
Andreas, to turn back to the transparency point.
Yes, Carl.
So, you know, you started off today with the example of the Sesame score.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something where it started off, I think, because it served a useful purpose to have this score for commercial transactions. And then, I know, early in the book, you say that people started requiring it on dating sites. Too.
Yes, that's true.
Yes,
absolutely. By her company I used to do consulting for in China, you have to provide your Sesame score and then only match you up with people within a certain band. Because, you know, if you are an 800 and I'm a 400, I mean, that date isn't going far.
So it became embedded into all of these social and commercial interactions and have, you know, sustained itself through these network effects. But then, even with transparency, how do people who don't like the way that the algorithm has changed then
right, make
that
a change, yeah.
And take that control?
So I think the control we can claim is a seat at the controls, if you will. So, for example, on the dating site, to stick to that example, a couple of points. One is making the implicit explicit. The dating site might know that you are only clicking on people with glasses, although that is maybe not a criterion which you have. But back to the score. Let's say on the dating site, what if your edit history is visible? So on Facebook, for instance, if I edit a post, people see what I changed. And that's a very powerful way to actually make it less likely that people are faking things. Mm-hmm. What about LinkedIn? We had a person who worked for us for about a week until he was fired. And, you know, a few years later, I see his resume, and it said that he was the CTO of our company. So if you saw the edit history that he was an intern, you know, 1 week, and then he slowly moved, I mean, some said he was a CTO of a fintech startup in the Bay Area. If we had the history of how people change facts, whether it's a dating site or a LinkedIn, it would change the behavior. So for me, one thing is the data we have, the other one is by being transparent of what it is, you change the behavior for the better or worse. But I think that creating the transparency and knowing what other people know about me is actually something which helps people. Like Terry and I in the story of the yellow, the yellow desk.
Which are we going
to? Okay. We are not hearing that. The idea.
I'm going to be a shameless shill for you. Hang on just 1 second. I'm going to take off my jacket.
Okay, now we take.
Yeah.
All right.
I've got my prompt. I'm going to start selling books now at the back. I'm my Data for the People sweatshirt, which is not otherwise available.
So
by the way.
It is not, and no. I should say there is one copy waiting in Russia, a copy which I wanted to give Putin, but security really made it very clear to me that me throwing that thing to Putin before he was coming up today, that would not have been anywhere. It is waiting in Russia. I got an email from the Ritz-Carlton saying, your package where it says ES on top has not been picked up. What do we do with it?
And it was for?
Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden, of course. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So we do have, if anyone's interested, we do have some books, Politics and Prose is allowing us to sell it at a 20% discount, and Andreas is happy to sign it and to talk to you and answer any other questions. There's still a ton of food and drinks, so I hope you guys will stay around and chat for a while. Thank you for coming. This is such a great group.
And thank you for having it. Thank you for having it. Thank you for
Thank you.